This is the story of 12,000 Spitfires that almost never got built. I'm Tuppence Middleton, and this is Spitfire, the people's plane. The first Spitfire factories at the start of the Second World War were on the south coast of England, an easy target for German bombers. But there was, eventually, another factory in the English Midlands.
I was sitting in my office in Southampton one day. I had a phone call to say, pack a bag, we're going to Birmingham. The factory was designed by the Nuffield organisation just to produce Spitfires.
It sounded really good at the time, but things did fall apart a little bit.
This part of the story begins right back in 1935, long before war broke out.
The story of Castle Bromwich is a sickening tale of ministerial ineptitude, bureaucratic incompetence, managerial weakness and ignorance, and an overdose of worker bloody-mindedness. Castle Bromwich was the sick joke in aviation circles.
So let's go back to 1935. In direct violation of the Treaty of Versailles, Hitler begins to rearm Germany. It is an act of aggression that can't be ignored. The British government realises that the country's safety will depend on the battles in the air. It needs more aircraft. But Britain simply doesn't have the factories to build them fast enough. Their solution to this problem was the shadow factory scheme.
The motor industry. They shadowed the aircraft factories.
David Rogers is a scientist and author who's written about the administration of the First and Second World Wars.
I've got some personal experience because my grandfather worked in the shadow factory at Eden, because you may have gathered from my accent, I'm a Yorkshireman. What the government wanted to do was to bolster up the aircraft manufacturing capability to modernise the RAF, and the concept of shadow factories took over from that.
The shadow scheme aimed to get mechanics, engineers and managers from Britain's thriving automotive industry to shadow aircraft factories so they could learn how to make aeroplanes. The government would build and equip new factories and the motor car companies would staff them. Rolls-Royce established one in Glasgow, Rover set up one in Solihull and Ford in Manchester, all making aeroplanes or parts of aeroplanes. And for the Spitfire, a brand new, massive state-of-the-art factory was to be built in the Midlands, in a village just to the east of Birmingham, called Castle Bromwich. Cyril Russell, the apprentice wheeler we met earlier in the series, 19 years old and making Spitfires in Southampton, was watching the process unfold with some envy.
It was agreed that the Nuffield organisation would shadow the Spitfire production. New, purpose-built factories were erected with all speed, and in Castle Bromwich's instance, they had tooling. Rubber presses, brake presses and the like, which the Woolston Supermarine factory had never known.
The Secretary of State for Air, Sir Kingsley Wood, handed over control for the new factory to Morris Motors, with William Richard Morris at the helm. He was a wealthy motoring magnate in his early 60s, and he was better known to everyone as Lord Nuffield.
For aviation this week, there's plenty of interesting material, and Sir Kingsley Wood is responsible for a lot of it. When he greets Lord Nuffield so effusively at Castle Bromwich, the Air Minister has in his pocket an order for 1,000 Spitfires, and for the factory which will turn them out, he cuts the first sod.
By 1938, then, the situation was looking hopeful, promising, you might think. A brand new factory with government money behind it, and a motor industry champion at the helm. Britain's Spitfire production is in the bag. But the factory wasn't to make a single Spitfire for 2 years. Journalist Leo McKinstry wrote about it in his book, Spitfire, Portrait of a Legend.
It was one of the biggest undertakings ever by the British state, and it cost £7 million, a huge sum. It was meant to turn out 1,000 Spitfires by the summer of 1940. And yet, by the summer of 1940, not a single Spitfire had been turned out.
The full story of why Castle Bromwich got off to such a catastrophic start is complicated. Firstly, there was the man in charge, Lord Nuffield.
Nuffield was, in his heyday, a tremendously successful businessman who was seen as the master of mass production, and they were all excited of getting this great name to take over the production of the Spitfire. But by the late 1930s, he was slightly past his best. He was becoming increasingly eccentric, had odd habits like throwing lighted cigarettes on the floor, and he drank huge amounts of bicarbonate of soda, thinking that it would cure his wind, but it actually made it worse.
Then there was tragedy.
The chap that was asked to run the factory was a guy called Oliver Borden, who was Nuffield's deputy at Morris Motors. He quickly started producing the necessary infrastructure within the buildings to get the thing done. But he died at the start of the war, and Nuffield was leaned upon to take a replacement that he wasn't particularly happy with.
The idea was that the shadow factory at Castle Bromwich would shadow the work already going on at Supermarine in Southampton. But communication between the two left a lot to be desired. Dennis Webb, long-suffering spare parts manager at Supermarine, saw it at first hand.
There was plenty of direct communication between Castle Bromwich and ourselves via a teleprinter. It tattered away all day and half the night, asking for bits and pieces to overcome shortages, or asking for advice on drawing queries and such like. And it did its best to drive me and the others mad. We were having a big enough struggle to build up our output of aircraft without worrying about Castle Bromwich. There was plenty of direct communication, and some of it was pretty rude.
And the new workforce at the Shadow Factory were a problem too. Half of them had been transplanted wholesale from the car industry. They'd never worked on planes before.
All the motor industry guys were professional engineers, but they did need time to get to grips with how to manoeuvre large wing assemblies, and the components for the motor industry were far smaller and lighter. The sheer scale of what they were asked to do, it must have been a difficult thing to get to grips with.
The other half of the workforce were brand new, drafted in hurriedly for the war effort from anywhere and everywhere. Castle Bromwich General Manager Stan Woodley recalls,
"The employees here were a complete mixed bag. We had lion tamers, we had variety artists, we had footballers. We had the lot."
Work was tough, and the hours were long. Some of the factory workers recorded their memories for a BBC documentary.
We used to work, though, in those days, 6 days a week. And in the offices, it was eight or six.
Yeah. In fact, we all did that, those sort of hours. Well, and there were people that worked 2 and 3 nights on the trot without any break at all.
Of course, it was a heck of a night shift. When you changed over from days to nights, you did 7 in the Saturday morning till 12, and you did 28 nights straight off. It was a month about in those days.
There certainly were instances where the workers were disgruntled because of the hours they were spending on site.
At various points, the workers at Castle Bromwich were so unhappy that they downed tools completely. Cyril Russell was working flat out making Spitfires himself, and the gossip about Castle Bromwich filtered back to him in Southampton.
Word soon passed back from our chaps there that the project was bugged with industrial action, or inaction. The cumulative result ensured no Spitfires reached the flight testing stage.
By the time Winston Churchill became Prime Minister in 1940, the farce at Castle Bromwich was a national embarrassment. He needed someone to shake things up. And who did he turn to? Lord Beaverbrook.
When Beaverbrook saw that not one Spitfire had yet to come from the enormous and expensive investment at Castle Bromwich, he sailed into battle in typical Beaverbrook style. He sent Sir Richard Fairey to assess the situation and report back to him personally.
Sir Richard Fairey was another giant of the British manufacturing industry, the founder of Fairey Aviation. The report he sent back was shocking.
Labour is in a very bad state. Discipline is lacking. Men are leaving before time and coming in late, taking evenings off when they think fit. In parts of the factory, I noticed that the men didn't even stir themselves at the approach of the works manager.
It was time for Beaverbrook to do what Beaverbrook did best. Take charge and tread on a few toes. He got on the phone, first to Lord Nuffield himself.
He had a long talk over the phone with Nuffield, and Nuffield was outraged at the tone Beaverbrook was taking. He said, "Maybe you would like me to give up control of the Spitfire factory." And in a flash came the reply from Beaverbrook, "Nuffield, why, that's very generous of you. I accept."
Next, he made an urgent call to Sir Charles Craven, the managing director of Vickers, the parent company of Supermarine. His call came at an awkward time.
Beaverbrook rang up Sir Charles, whose secretary said that he was unavailable as he was attending to the wants of nature. This was no good for Beaverbrook, who sent a message back that Sir Charles must come to the phone immediately. Sir Charles instructed his secretary to inform Lord Beaverbrook that Sir Charles can only attend to one at a time.
Beaverbrook handed over control of Castle Bromwich to Vickers in its entirety. A lot of the top talent from the original Southampton factory were poached to help get things working. Stan Woodley was one of those who was called up.
Beaverbrook, who was a tremendous power in those days, decided that he needed to have somebody with aircraft experience to produce some aeroplanes required very, very quickly. I was sitting in my office in Southampton one day. I had a phone call to say, pack a bag, we're going to Birmingham. And we walked in and took over the factory.
At first, slowly, and then at blistering speed, the factory fortunes began to turn around. Beaverbrook's big moment of triumph came in the summer of 1940. A mere 6 weeks after dramatically sacking Lord Nuffield, 10 completed Spitfires, the first 10, known as the 10 in June, rolled off the production lines at Castle Bromwich. It was a moment of redemption. But even that didn't quite go to plan.
There were a few big wigs that turned up. Sir Alex Dunbar was there and some of his senior staff. But the test pilot, Henshaw, turned up first thing in the morning. And to his dismay, the plane wasn't ready. And it only became ready just as it was starting to get dark, 8, 9 o'clock in the evening. But nevertheless, he took off and did the customary rolls and loops and all the other things associated with Spitfires in films, and wowed his audience, and everyone was really happy.
The bigwigs may have been impressed, but Dennis Webb saw the whole spectacle for what it was, a charade.
We had at that time a contract for Spitfires for Turkey. 11 had been test flown and sent for crating and shipment. Then, on instructions from the Air Ministry, the shipment was cancelled. We were thus in a position to pass 10 complete Spitfires to Castle Bromwich in May to reappear as the 10 in June.
This was a classic Beaverbrook publicity stunt. But in its way, it galvanised the exhausted and chastised workforce and gave them something to be proud of.
It was tremendous.
Hell of a lot. Mm. When you went through C block, which was the final shot, and to see them lined up, you know, ready to go ferried across the road for testing,
sight.
It was a wonderful sight.
It wasn't just like putting nuts and bolts together. You felt a lot of satisfaction of when you're seeing this plane go out with Alec Henshaw.
You knew that things had got to be perfect or as near perfect as possible, and you made a special effort.
There was one remaining problem, and it was a big one. The largest aircraft factory in the country makes a prime target for German bombs.
Several bombing raids were made to try to locate the factories, but because the Germans obviously didn't know where they were, they were always way off target.
Donald Thompson grew up in the neighbouring city of Birmingham, which itself was brutally bombed in the Birmingham Blitz. He was 12 when war broke out.
Most of the German attacks towards 42, 43 were concentrated on the Castle Bromwich area, where there was a huge shadow factory. So I think the Germans had a vague idea where the factory was, because that particular part of Birmingham was bombed quite heavily.
One raid in 1942 got a direct hit. General Manager Stan Woodley was on the scene as soon as possible.
I got there about half an hour after the bombing, and I remember treading on people. There were people blown up in the roof.
And I stood outside the gate and they said, you come in if you like, but the DA's all over the place.
DA's, delayed action bombs, were lying among the wreckage, ready to explode at any moment. But the work of making Spitfires was too important to be stopped. Work simply carried on around them.
I come to the top into my shop in E Block, and when I walked in, the governor gave me a screw bin, a small screw bin, and some mutton cloth and said, stick that on your head and get on with your job.
Over the years, there's been so much confusion about Castle Bromwich, what went wrong and who was to blame, that it's often hard to get a clear view. For most, it was nothing short of a national disgrace, with incompetent leadership and work-shy staff who let Spitfire parts gather dust on factory floors when they were needed most. But among the chorus of blame and accusation, there is a voice of dissent. Supermarine spare parts manager, fixer, mover and shaker, Dennis Webb. As a manager, he had access to more information than most and was a little more cautious in assigning blame.
There are many unknowns in all of this, and it seems to be quite impossible to get a clear idea of how things really progressed. When we at the parent firm tendered for our first production contract for Spitfires, our chairman, Sir Robert McLean, promised that we would deliver our first aircraft in 15 months from date of contract. We thought 15 months was a reasonable time to jigger and tool up and get the first aircraft out. So on the basis of our own judgment, we would not have expected Nuffield to produce his first Spitfire until July 1940. And yet in early May 1940, Beaverbrook was asking Lord Nuffield why he had not produced any Spitfires.
Perhaps history has been a little too quick to judge the Castle Bromwich fiasco. After all, there had never been anything like it, for size, for advanced machinery, for sheer ambition, anywhere before.
When, in fact, did Castle Bromwich produce their first machine? The answer is July 1940, when they produced 23. It seems to me that producing 23 aircraft in 15 months from date of contract was a commendable performance, and Lord Nuffield did not deserve such treatment, especially at the hands of a newspaper tycoon who knew nothing of aircraft engineering.
Castle Bromwich Aircraft Factory, after a rocky start, went on to become the most successful shadow factory of the war. It set a new standard for production line engineering and built over half of all Britain's Spitfires, nearly 12,000 of them. Next week, we meet the men and women designing Spitfires in secret in an 18th century mansion in the pastoral Hampshire countryside.
Hello there, I'm Ed Butler.
And I'm Manuela Saragossa. And we're the presenters of the Business Daily podcast from the BBC World Service.
Now, we have been asked to tell you all about our podcast and why you should listen to it. So, Manuela, what is Business Daily all about?
You know, Ed, that's a really difficult question because it does a lot more than it says on the tin. I mean, it talks about money, work, the economy, the office, the big policy issues.
Maybe we shouldn't be called Business Daily at all. Maybe we should have another name like In the Money, On the Money, With the Money. Here's Manuela with the money. That makes you sound like a drug dealer.
It does. Crystal ball gazing, I thought.
Oh, interesting.
Because we do a lot of looking at the future of work and industry. And curveballs as well, because we do throw our listeners some pretty random stuff, like how to be mediocre and still love yourself, or the business case for sleep.
Mystic Manuela, ahead of the curve. OK, you lot at home, you get to decide. Give us a listen, tell us what you think, and perhaps tell us what to call ourselves.
Just look for BBC Business Daily wherever you download your podcasts.
Business Daily, then.
Business Daily.